I think you can hear me okay. That's good. I'm glad to see you this morning.
Let's see if that's not.
I think that's good. All right. Very good. Good to see everyone here. I see a good crowd and a lot of excitement to see each other. That's great. That's very uplifting. And this morning we're going to continue our Bible studies on the miracles of Jesus. I know several men have been teaching on different miracles, and we're going to teach one more. And then I think there's one more next Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. And I think we're very close to the end. And I can surely say you're saving the best for last, as far as teachers. I can surely say that because I'm not the last one. So I can say that. But, okay, so we can go to... this morning we're going to go over Jesus' power over death. That's the miracle we're going to look at. In fact... Okay, so we're going to be... Actually, let me ask you this question right to begin. How many instances are recorded in the New Testament only of people being resurrected by Jesus? How many accounts are there registered? And of course, I'm going to ask how many people were resurrected by Jesus, because we don't know how many. But there's a number that was recorded. Who can remember?
230.
Yeah, okay, yes, and you got it right. Which instances are those?
Lazarus.
Yes.
The young
girl. Yes. Yes, absolutely. So we have the account of Lazarus, that's John 11, being raised from the dead. We also have the account of the daughter of Jairus. It was a 12-year-old girl that died. And then we also have the account of the widow's son of the city of Nain, which we're going to start with that account right now. And we will not cover all three accounts. We might go to two accounts if possible, but only we're going to begin with one. If you want to open your scriptures to Luke chapter 7, we're going to begin with the account of the widow's son. Okay, and this is found in Luke chapter 7, and beginning in verse 11. Now, just briefly in the context, if you see 7 and verse 1, you're going to see the city of Capernaum, okay? And that's where Jesus made his home, so his dwelling, while he was at Galilee. That was what people call scholars call it his headquarters, okay, where he will go and rest and stay. And every time the scripture says, or the New Testament says, and he went back, it's implying he's going back to Capernaum. That's where he came out from. Okay, so we see he's in Capernaum. Now, it's about 25, if you know where Capernaum is, it's right on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, of the Lake of Galilee. It's right on the north. If you go down 25 miles southeast, you're going to find a mountain known as Little Horn. Okay, it has different names, but Little Hermon. This is in comparison to Big Hermon, Mount Hermon, which is the biggest one that there is in that land. But this is called Little Hermon, okay? And in the northern slope, okay, of this mountain is found the city of Nain. Very interesting, and you can find this on your map, maybe in your Bible it will show. But on the southern shore of that same mountain is found another city called Shuhem. I don't know if this rings a bell or not, but it's very significant that several hundred years back, in that same mountain, but on the opposite side, they also used to live a family whose son passed away. And he was resurrected as well. Now we come several hundred years later. Now we're going to move to the northern section of that same mountain, that Little Hermon. And we're going to find the city of Nain. And then notice what happened. Let me just read this, begin reading this section. What happened in this city? Verse 11. Now it happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain. And many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. Now, very interesting, right at the beginning, that it says that it happened the day after Okay, the day after what? The day after they were in Capernaum. Okay, so we see the context on Capernaum, what happened. And now we see that it's 25 miles southeast of Capernaum. It's about a day's travel to get to the city of Nain. So we see one thing right off the bat, that Jesus' ministry was intensive. Okay, we see 3.5 years is a short time. So his ministry was intensive. So we see here that he's traveling almost all day long, or a day's journey to get to this city of Nain. And then he continues his ministry here, okay, in this city. So we see the day after. Now, keep in mind when it says the day after, that the Jewish reckon days, they are different way than we do. Okay, for us it's midnight, it starts a new day. For them, sunset starts a new day. So most likely, he might have left Capernaum during the day or early in the morning, arrive at Nain by sunset, and that's the next day. Even though for us it's the same day, but for them it's the next day. And it could have happened. It could have been that this funeral procession we're about to read of happened in the evening. Okay, what could have been? Okay, so we see here. It happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain. Okay, now we see that he traveled 25 miles southeast. Okay, and notice, and many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. So there's a lot of people following Jesus to this city. Okay, we don't know if they're coming all the way from Capernaum or people are joining him as he's traveling along the way. But there's a big crowd, and his disciples with him, okay, following him. Now, before I forget, close to the city of Nain, okay, in fact, 2 miles east of Nain, you see, it's within walking distance, is another city mentioned in the Old Testament called as Endor. Okay, Endor. And I don't know if this rings a bell as well, but Endor was the city where Samuel appeared last to Saul. It's the city where this woman, this witch, lived. You know, that Saul went and consulted her, and then God took that opportunity to let Samuel speak to Saul. Okay, in that story. Okay, and that's the city of Endor. It's close to Nain as well, very close. And then we see that we're going to see just a moment that Nain was a big enough city to have walls. Okay, so this city, important cities or cities that were big enough, needed this protection, these walls. So we're going to see that in just a moment. Okay, so let's see. Okay, let me keep on reading here. 7:12, and then verse 12. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, okay. And now Luke is using this word, behold, again. He came near the gate of the city. We see the city was walled and had a gate, okay. And as he's coming near, look what happened. A dead man was being carried out. And then Luke mentions not only the only son of his mother. And then he also adds, and she was a widow. Very interesting when we compare the stories, when we go to the story of Jairus' daughter, this 12-year-old young woman was also the only daughter of this family. Okay? And there's no metaphor behind this. This is just how they were. This is literal. Okay? They were only children in this case. Okay, unlike Lazarus. Lazarus was not an only child. He had two sisters that we know of, mentioned in scriptures. Okay, so we see that this is a widow. Very interesting the way he mentions he's being carried out. Okay, most likely this was kind of an open stand where the body was exposed. You know, as the funeral procession was going through, people can look at the body. Can look at the person lying down in that stand, and it was not unusual for people to be, you know, carried like this on funeral processions. In fact, Herod himself was carried like this fashion, you know, in a more fancy way, you know, more gold, more, you know, purple and things like that. But his body was also exposed to be seen to those who walked by. Okay, so we see this funeral procession here, and this is just basically cultural facts. Okay. Now, again, he mentions the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, okay? And before I move on, can you imagine losing your only child? I cannot. It's not something that I can imagine or you know, try to put my feet, those shoes. It's something that I can try to fathom or try to reach out to, you know, some sad moments in my life, but nothing that I've been through might compare to something like that, I don't think. Not at all. Maybe you've been through something like that, or you know someone like that, and you know how sad, how sorrowful this widow felt about her loss. Okay, but we're gonna see Jesus' compassion here in this situation, and but notice, it mentions that a large crowd from the city was with her. So we're gonna see here two crowds coming face to face, and the point of union is gonna be this corpse or this young man dead, and Jesus Christ, and the mother of this young man. Okay, so as they approach the city, there's two large crowds that are meeting face to face. One going out of the city, the other one coming into the city. And then notice what happens. Verse 13. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Okay? It's very significant as we move on. And of course, you can, if you want to make a comment, you're welcome to. I don't want to take all the time, but it says the Lord. If you notice, I pay attention, I took note of this fact that Luke calls him the Lord. If you go to Matthew, if you go to Mark, and even in John, you're going to see them addressing Jesus as Jesus. But not Luke in this instance. In fact, Luke is going to go back and forth, but several times, at least it's about 10 times, he's going to call him Lord. Okay, Luke is going to call him Lord. Let's not lose sight of that. So Luke is saying, when the Lord saw her, okay? And just keep in mind also that Luke is writing several years after the fact that this happened. And he's saying, yes, he was Lord. He is the Lord. Okay, and then when he saw her, he had compassion on her, and said to her, "Do not weep." And so far, everything looks, you know, natural, the way the flow of human, you know, activity will be. You see someone who is suffering, and then you have compassion on her, and what I mean is telling her to not weep, okay? It's something that maybe will not call the attention of the crowds too much, as it would the next verse when he stopped everyone and then talked to the young man. But you see, compassion. Okay, so he's reaching out to these feelings. He's trying to be on her shoes. He's trying to you know, to be, I don't know what the word will be, but he's feeling this heart with her. He's trying to feel what she's feeling. So he had compassion on her, and then he gave her some words. Do not weep. Notice verse 14. And now here, you know, If there's a funeral procession and then someone, you know, stops the funeral procession to talk to the coffin, now that's when things are going to get, you know, what's going on? What is he doing? Well, is he, what's this? So this is what Jesus is doing. He's verse 14. And then he came and touched the open coffin. And those who carried him stood still. Here you go, you're moving, you're trying to take him to the place where he's going to be buried. Sure enough, he comes someone, and he has, you know, he's wishing the widow, do not cry, he's comforting her, and that's when I say this will look normal in the general sense, although Jesus had a different, you know, approach than probably we would have had. But then everyone stops, because he's touching the coffin, and he's about to address this body laying down there. And that's where, you know, if anyone would do that, we would think, well, he's crazy. He's out of his mind. He's not in his right. Why is he trying to do this? But you see, the Lord, he wasn't crazy. Luke himself already said he's the Lord. Okay, so he's not lunatic, like we would say. He knows what he's doing. He has authority to do so. And he is who he says he is. Okay, he can do this. So then, and he said, young man, I say to you, arise. Now, this is going to give us a common factor that you can see in every of the people that were recorded that he resurrected. What did he do in every instance of these three accounts that we just mentioned? Every time, you know, let's just flip the pages real quick. Every time he's going to call out their names or talk to them. Every time. Okay, so we see here, young man, I say to you, arise. Notice Mark 5:41. We're going to see here, and very interesting how Luke, how Mark records it in Aramaic and gives the translation. But in Mark 41, and it says, then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumi, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. Okay, he's talking now to the little girl. Now, going back to John chapter 11 and verse 43, we're going to see the same thing happening with Lazarus. John 11 and verse 43. Let's see. Now, when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. You see, there's a difference here with Lazarus because they were close friends, so he knew his name very well. So he's calling him by his name. The other young man is calling him young man, and then the girl is calling her little girl. Okay? So we see in all of these instances that he's calling them, you know, to come. He's talking to them. Alright? Now let's go back to Luke chapter 7, and then in over in verse 14. Now notice verse 15. So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. Okay? And he presented him to his mother. Can you imagine, you know, the feeling of her mother to see his dead son back to life? Not only sitting down on his own, but also talking to her. This is just unimaginable. This is something, you know, unimaginable if you haven't gone through this. Because I assume none of us have gone through something like this. It's just something that, you know, gives hope that there's someone who has power beyond ours, and he has power even over death, which is one of the things that scares us, I would say, some of us the most. I know there's some who are not afraid. I used to not be afraid of death when I was young and single. Okay, I can tell you that. I will go anywhere. I will go by night, many different countries as much as I could. But now that I'm married and have my children, the first thing I think of, something happens to me, I know they're going to keep on going on, but it's going to be an emotional, it's going to be hard for them, okay, to lose their father. And that's what scares me the most. It's not more, so more myself, but my wife and my children, which I know the Lord will take care of them. I'm not indispensable, but I don't want them to go through pain and suffering and things like that. And my heart goes out. You know, I have, I know you also know, you know, children who have lost their parents being young, and that's not something really funny to, or, you know, to think of. But anyways, he has power over death. And that's what gives us hope. Okay, it's not over. When we die, it's not over. It's not the end. Okay, there's a resurrection coming. So let's keep on doing. And in verse 16, then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people. Okay, so we see here, when we talk about Jesus's performing miracles, there were two main purposes, or several purposes, when he performed a miracle. One of them was, of course, to bring obedient faith to those who, you know, who saw the miracle in order for them to be saved. Another purpose of doing miracles, and I'm talking about Jesus specifically, is to confirm that he was who he said he was, that he was the Son of God, that he was deity. And by his miracles, he will confirm this and also try to produce obedient faith on those who were, at least that was the purpose. You know, we see seated like Capernaum, whom had the privilege to see a lot of Jesus' miracles, but they still did not believe. And later he's going to say that in the judgment day, is going to be more terrible, more for Sodom and Gomorrah, because they did not get the privilege to see any of these miracles than to Capernaum, who had the privilege to see many of Jesus' miracles, yet opposed them in many ways. So we see but the purpose is still to produce obedient faith in those who saw the miracle, to believe in Jesus. Okay? Now we see here, let me just make a brief parenthesis, and right after this story, we're going to see that in verse 18, we're going to see that some disciples of John are going to come to Jesus, okay? It says, then the disciples of John reported to him concerning all these things, and then John, he called two of his disciples, and then he sent them to ask of Jesus, are you the one, or should we look for another one? And notice the answer Jesus is going to give him, okay? Then Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John the things you have seen and heard, that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the dead are raised. Notice, the dead are raised, which implies that not only were just this young man, not only was Lazarus, not only was the daughter of Jairus, but there were more dead men who were being raised by Jesus. And this goes in accord to what John 20 and the last part of his book wrote, that there were many signs that they could not have been written, but these were chosen to produce faith on us, faith in Jesus Christ. So Jesus saying that the dead are being raised. There's dead people who are being raised. Tell John this. Tell him this. Okay, the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me. So we see here, just want to make this small point, that there could have been more people being raised by Jesus besides the ones we have recorded of. Any comments so far right here? Yes, please. Okay.
Why did he make sure to say the gospel is preached to?
Okay, in this section we're reading, what we just read, okay, that's a good question.
I mean, not to just everybody, but to the poor. Why
not? Okay, that's a very good question. And when we're talking about the poor, if you remember when he said, blessed are the poor in spirit, okay, he's talking about and not how much people have, but the concept they have of themselves. Okay, so we see people who are poor in spirit, and the people who are poor in spirit are the ones who said, yes, I need someone besides me to guide me into what I must do to please God. I need help outside of me. I cannot do it on my own. That's a poor in spirit person, a humble person. So he's saying, yes, the gospel is being preached to people who have this attitude. He's not necessarily talking about, you know, economically poor. But as we see, there were some important men like Nicodemus, who, and Jairus himself, I'm sure he became a believer of Jesus after he resurrected his daughter. But he was a ruler in the synagogue, an important person, you know, an educated man, who I'm sure had a poor spirit attitude after what Jesus did for him. Any other comments? Yeah, that's a good comment. I'm glad you asked that.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Is this the same kind of poor that when Paul went back to Jerusalem to early the apostles, that they talked about taking care of the poor?
Okay, and that's a very good question as well, and it goes along with this word. In that case, he's talking about the saints who were in need. You know, there was a famine, there was adverse conditions in that land. In fact, several famines are mentioned in the Old Testament, and back in those days, they were in adverse condition. And Paul was collecting a collection to help those in need, could not help themselves materially. Good question. Thank you, Brother Jerry. Yes, and you know, and if I don't know the answer, I'll study it, and then we'll come back. And if not, you can ask Brian. He's right here. Put him on the spot. No, but anyways, let's go back. Thank you for those comments. Appreciate it. And yeah, keep them coming. It's good. All right. And then, okay, let's just finish the story and then see if we have a few minutes to go back to the other story. So we see here, verse 16, and then fear came upon all and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us and God has visited his people. Can you imagine this? A young man has been resurrected and then people are, you know, quiet in awe. What did just happen? Because he's not, you know, in this occasion, in Jairus's case, it was only a few who went into that room to Jesus to hold that little girl's hand and bring her up. But this is something being done openly. Remember, there's two crowds on each side, and Jesus and the widow and her son right in the middle. And when they see this, and they're, you know, amazed, and then someone out of the crowd is gonna shout, a great prophet has risen among these people. Yes, people will maybe reply or say amen or some kind of, you know, assent to what he said or someone said. And then afterwards someone said, well, God has visited his people. Yes. So you see the excitement of seeing this miracle being done. Yet, it is significant, and I wanted to point this out, that although this miracle was significant, there was still some kind of struggle among people to declare Jesus, this man Jesus, as being the Messiah. Maybe one reason was because they might have not connected the dots that the Messiah was going to be a supernatural person. Just keep in mind that they were hoping for a Messiah who would be a ruler, who would be someone with military powers, military tactics. He was going to take back the kingdom to the glory it had when David was reigning, when Solomon was reigning. That was their hope. So you see a man who has power to raise the dead. They say, well, he must be like someone like Elijah or Elijah, who also raised dead people. So it's a case, a great prophet. Okay, but yet at the same time, when John the Baptist came preaching, people asked him, are you the Messiah or not? And John said, no, I'm not the Messiah. He's coming right after me. Okay, so we see here, it can be taken both ways when they say a great prophet has risen. It could mean the Messiah has come, or it just could mean that the people were still struggling. If you remember, the Jews will pressure those who believe openly in Jesus. Okay, so some of those were secret disciples. I will not openly confess Jesus as the Christ, as the Messiah. And it could be that they were still struggling with this idea. But then some said, and they declared in this last part, when they said, God has visited his people. Now, they could have remembered that Jesus claimed to forgive sins. And this is only something that belongs to God. Jesus also was accused of blasphemy because he considered himself equal to God. So some people might have kept this in mind and say, no, this is Emmanuel. Like the angel told Mary and Joseph, this is Emmanuel. Is God with us? And they were right. He was God with them. He was God with us in human flesh. But deity, being able to forgive sins, being comfortable with receiving worship, being able to cure every type of disease, preaching with authority, and not only that, being able to raise the dead. And some said, God has come with us, has come and visited us. This is God, no one but God himself. And they were right. Okay, any comments before we flip the pages? Yes, please.
Do you think it's possible that people could have remembered the virgin birth too at this point? Because this was Jesus. I mean, the virgin birth was a big deal, a big thing. And it was at that time that the angel said to them that he is going to be called Emmanuel, God with us. Could they have been making a connection that this was the same Jesus in which that great thing happened as well?
Yes, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, Isaiah 7:14, this prophecy of being born, the virgin will conceive a child. Yes, absolutely. I think that's also making that connection. that supernatural quality of the Messiah. Not only a human, not only a ruler, but a spiritual ruler with this quality of being able to, you know, perform miracles. And yes, thank you. Yes, ma'am. I think so. Okay, let's do this. We have only a few minutes. And let's see if I'm not missing something here. But if we flip the pages, just a few pages forward, let's just read this account of Jairus. It's going to be in Luke chapter 8 as well. I mean, in Luke as well, but in chapter 8. And now let me just make this point. Both of these accounts happen in Galilee. Okay, Galilee. Okay, the account of Lazarus happened in the south, which is Judea. Okay, so I said, Galilee was a very blessed region. And my mind is always, if you read Isaiah 9 later when you have time, you're going to see how Galilee was a very, what would be the word to describe it? Was a very attacked piece of land. They were always under attack. When foreign rulers will come, the first place they will come through was Galilee because they're coming from the north. And in fact, the Syrians took first the northern kingdom. And then the Babylonians took the southern kingdom. So every time someone tried to conquer, except for Egypt, who will come from the south, they will come from the north. And every battle will be fought in Galilee. And they'll suffer every time. But that when Jesus came, Galilee had the privilege to see the most miracles. You see, a land who had suffered so much physically was being comforted so much spiritually when Jesus came. Okay, so I like to think about that. So we're still in Galilee now, and we're back in Capernaum. We're in the north. I'm in Luke chapter 8, verse 40. And it says, so it was when Jesus returned. This is what I was saying. When he returned, he's implying he's going back to Capernaum. Okay? Now when Jesus returned, that the multitude welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. Let me make this point here. Where Jesus was from, you know, he will, as a good Jew, he will go to the synagogue and read and participate. But it was in that region where he suffered a lot of opposition, especially from the rulers. And I don't know if Jairus could have been among those who were antagonistic to Jesus until this point. But he knew those who were against him. That's for sure. But now we see now, behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house. We see him with a great need. And when we're in great need, we're not bashful. Bashful goes out of the window. We're in a need. We are suffering. We are going to ask for help to whoever we think can help us. Okay? Now he goes down into Jesus' feet and begged him. He's begging, please, please, come to my house. I need you to come to my house. And then Luke explains why. For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. But as he went, the multitudes oppressed him. Now notice, there's going to be a parenthesis here beginning in verse 43 through verse 48. And we're not going to go through this. You know the story of this woman with the issue of blood. But can you imagine? You're coming here with a pressing need. And you're begging him to come to your house right now. But then Jesus takes the time for this woman with the issue of blood. And now put yourself in the situation of the woman of the issue of blood. Jesus being so much busy, so much pressed by people, many requests, but yet she was courage enough to ask a request and go and touch his garment. And then we see the rest of the story. So it could have been very much, you know, stressful for Jairus to wait until all of this happened in order for Jesus to turn back around and look at him and then address his need. Okay, I know we can get impatient a lot of times, but this man had to be patient in the middle of these pressing circumstances. He had to. He had to wait for the only source of help that he had. Now, we're going to skip to verse 49. And then it says, while he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher." We see two things here. They acknowledge that Jesus, yes, was very busy, but they also acknowledge that they did not have faith in Jesus when they said, "Well, just leave him alone. She's dead. There's nothing that can be done." Okay, and that, this is probably the thinking, you know, we have in general as far as dying, you see. And but with Jesus is not the case. There's something that can be done about death, right? And then we can also apply this to spiritual death. But let's keep on reading, okay? Verse 15. But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, "Do not be afraid." He knows what he's going through, fear. And he's telling him, only believe, and he shall be made well. Okay, there's faith also in this case, in this situation that's asked of him. Verse 51, when he came into the house, now, see, he has time to go into the house of Jairus. He's going to the house. Notice what happened. He permitted no one to go except Peter, James, and John, and the father of the mother, and the father and mother of the girl. Okay, so there's people there mourning. And if you read the accounts of Mark and Matthew, of this same account, you're going to learn that these were most likely, you know, hired mourners. And you're going to see that because of the attitude they're going to take towards Christ when he says, "She's only sleeping." They're going to mock him. Okay? Why would you mock someone when you are truly in suffering for someone's death? Okay? So let's keep on going before the time runs out. Okay, so he said he only permitted Peter, James, and John, and the father and the mother of the girl. Verse 52, now all wept and mourned for her. But he said, "Do not weep, she is not dead, but sleeping." Let me see, Mark 5:39 is a parallel account. And look the way he's going to tell her, he's going to tell them, when he came in the house, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." You see, Jesus's, and this is the point of this class, Jesus's approach to death is like an approach we would have to someone sleeping. All you have to do is call him to wake up. See? All you have to say, "Hey, wake up, it's time." That's the same approach Jesus has over death. And that's what's encouraging. That's the message. That's the key point that we want to make in this class, that Jesus has power over death. And just as we will wake up a child or your spouse or your wife or somebody, or your brother and sister, just as you can wake them up from sleep, Jesus say, "I can wake anybody up from death." That's the main point. So let's see if we can finish the story before the bell rings. Okay? And verse 53, and they ridiculed him, knowing that she was dead. And this was good in a way, because they were going to be witnesses that, yes, she was dead. There was no trick, no magic, no, trying to, you know, fool the people. These same people are going to be witnesses for what they're saying, because they were making fun of him, and they say, "No, she's indeed dead." Okay, and then verse 54, but he put them all outside, took her by the hand, and called her, and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." You see, when we're sleeping, we need to wake up and arise. And when we're dead, we also need to wake up and arise. Same thing. Okay, so he's telling him, "Arise, little girl, arise." Which tells us also that the little girl was not annihilated or just disappeared. She was somewhere when she could hear the word of the master of death, which is Jesus Christ. "Little girl, arise." Notice, and then another significant point here, verse 55, then her spirit returned, which tells us that we need a spirit to be able to be alive. Then her spirit returned. Okay? And she arose immediately. And he commanded that she be given something to eat. Now we see here in this verse, in contrast, the miraculous and the providential. We see the miraculous, which goes against nature. We cannot resurrect dead people. This is goes against our nature. But feeding someone food to eat, giving them water, that's providential. That's something we can do. So we see here side to side that the miraculous and the providential. In verse 55, and now verse 56, and her parents were astonished. But notice and the reaction of these people. They were astonished at what happened. I'm sure we would have been astonished as well. And then it says, and then just to finish, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. Okay? Jesus was very careful about these miracles going out into the open. You see, because, you know, people were expecting a Messiah, expecting a ruler, and then they say, well, if he can make miracles, then this is the one we need. Let's push him to make him our king. Let's crown him by force. And Jesus said, no, don't tell anybody. Let's just keep it like this. You see, unlike people who claim to do miracles nowadays, the more you advertise it, the better. Why? Because there's ulterior motives behind what they do. There's other motives. Jesus' motive was to help people and then to be able to establish the kingdom when the time came, the spiritual kingdom. Okay, I think I talked too much, but I appreciate your comments. They're very good. I hope it's made you think. I by no means tried to be thorough with these stories. And of course, we did not have time to go to John chapter 11, but I hope this gives you more interest in going back and reading these three stories again slowly and try to meditate and gain more from them. But make no mistake, brothers and sisters, we are victorious because Christ is victorious over death. He has power over death, and we have that benefit because they're God's children. Thank you for your attention.